Mr. Kerr, reel two.
To try and find something to eat, and mainly something to drink. We were stuck there all day whilst the Chinese attacked all round us. And the American bombers came in, or fighter bombers came in, dropped napalm very close to us all the way around. And I understand, I didn't see it, I understand they also tried to do an airdrop to us, but I don't think it succeeded. And then the following day, we were given the order, every man for himself, get out.
When the Chinese attacked, what was their method of attack?
Well, again, from where I was, I couldn't see them. But I understand they simply swarmed up the hillside.
Could you hear them?
Not from my side of the hill. Only the noise, you know, the rifles and machine guns, etc.
Was there food and drink to be had?
Very little. No water. There was a little food.
What happened when you got the order, every man for himself?
Well, other companies, I believe, were told to go first, but of course once they started to go, then of course everybody went. And I just followed everybody else off the hill and up this valley, going towards our own lines, we hope. During this period, We were fired overhead by machine guns, and various people, each time there was a bullet to fire, threw up their hands and stopped where they were. But a lot of us kept going, and just kept going and kept going, until we came into an open space and we were simply surrounded by Chinese. So we stopped, and rather a comical incident really, because the Chinese that I saw appeared to be extremely young, and they had what I believe they call stick bombs on the end of their fingers, and they were whizzing them round, and they came round and shook hands with us.
You mean they were twirling these stick bombs on their fingers?
Yeah. You know, like kids do.
How else did they behave?
Oh, how did they behave? Well, we were just moved to, I suppose, a quieter spot. And stopped there all day, and they just stood all the way around us. You know, in fact, there is a photograph in that book I'll show you later of us being there.
Did they search you?
Not then, no. They did later on the march.
Did any of them have any English?
Again, I wasn't in contact with any of them. Wait a minute. No, the next day, we collected our empty water bottles. I think about four of us collected as many as we could. And this soldier, Chinese soldier, took us to the stream to fill the water bottles. No, he couldn't speak, definitely couldn't speak. He pointed and gesticulated all the time.
Did anybody have any ideas of escape?
Oh, I did.
Did you?
No, I was too benumbed. I mean, there were a lot of us. We were just all together. and everybody was just bewildered, if you like, really.
How big a group had you been in when you tried to escape?
How did what?
How big a group had you been in when you tried to escape?
Well, I didn't try to escape.
No, when you got the every man for himself on.
There were hundreds of us screaming at this valley. Everybody. Well, apart from the I believe 32 got away from that hill. An officer led them in, who knew where they were. He led them out, and they did get away. But everybody else was captured.
What happened after you'd filled your water bottles?
I suppose you must have had some food at some time. I can't remember that. You must have been fed. And then we were taken at night back over the river, and we started our long trek north.
How did you cope with that? How did you cope with it?
Best you could. We only walked at night. During the day they hid us in houses and villages. We used to start off at, this was because of the American airplanes, and we used to walk all night long. When you're walking like that in paddy fields and paths, I mean, you're not going, obviously you're not going very fast, I mean, there's a few hundred of you on the move, and you just follow the man in front of you. Invariably we got lost when they tried to find somewhere for us to stop the night. That went on for altogether it took us about a month to reach the prisoner of war camp, because we had two stops on the way to halt. One was about 10 days, and that was worse than the walking, because it's so extremely boring. Because you were just there and you couldn't move, you couldn't get out anywhere, and you were really glad to be on the move again.
Were you out in the open or?
No. When we were walking, yeah, but not at night, no. They put us in a village at night. Yeah. And then as the as we got further and further and further north, and we started to walk during the day, and we just used to have to dive into the roadside if any aeroplanes came over. But that was much pleasanter. Apart from, we did pass through one North Korean town, I don't know what it was called, where the inhabitants were spitting at us, and wasn't a very pleasant experience at all. You know, you felt really degraded. But luckily we only passed through one big town.
How did the Chinese guards behave when you were being spat on?
I think the Chinese guards by then were as tired as we were, because they walked with us. What their actual reaction was, I don't know, because I didn't have one near me at the time. But you've got to remember that these Chinese guards were carrying all their kit, plus the cooking bowls that they cooked our food in.
Did you have to carry anything?
Occasionally we carried food. They put, this bean curd, not bean curd, but this sort of dry mash stuff, into long, thin rolls, like bicycle inner tubes, which are quite easy to carry if you just wrap it over your shoulder. And we were lucky really, because the weather was pretty mild in April.
What physical condition were you in on the march?
I would say pretty weakish, because most people had diarrhoea. That was the biggest problem, actually, apart from anybody who was wounded, was the state of your stomachs with this peculiar food we were eating. But at least every drop of water was boiled. I suppose that helped us a lot.
Did you have diarrhoea yourself?
I think everybody did.
Were there any casualties from the bombing? From the air attacks?
Not as I know.
Where did you end up?
I can't remember the name of it. But we ended up in this prison camp on the north, to the northwest. Where we stopped, we never moved from there. And everybody went there, you know, the officers, the sergeants, everybody went there. And then over the next few weeks, they separated us. The officers went off, were taken away from us, and the sergeants were taken away. And they then segregated us more or less by age. The younger ones were all in one section, and the older ones each in their separate sections. I suppose the next thing that happened is that they took our, I wouldn't say they took our uniforms away from us, but they were so, our uniforms were so lousy. They really were by this time, they were stinking. That we simply, they provided us with blue cotton jackets, trousers and shirts. We stripped off completely on the river bank. There's a river along the bottom, on the edge of the prison camp. We took everything off and dumped it on the bank, went into the river and washed ourselves, and came out on the other bank, put our clean clothing on. So we hoped that way we would get rid of all the louse, the lice. And that's really, I think, where I won't say you lost the feeling of being in the army, but you no longer wore an army uniform and army boots. Of course, the Chinese never called us prisoners of war. We were students. They referred to us as students. And we were to be taught the error of our ways. This was, I don't know about this, but this was started during the Chinese Civil War, where the Chinese decided that instead of putting vast quantities of their enemies into prisoners of war camp, they would re-educate them, teach them the errors of their ways, and put them in their own army, which was what they tried to do with us over the next 2 years. And it didn't work.
Why didn't it work?
Well, for one thing, we were far better educated than them. Far better. I mean, they just did not believe us when we said that we had cars and shops and what have you. They'd been brought up to believe, you know, that they were superior and they got everything and we had nothing, because this wasn't true. We, of course, couldn't speak their language at all, but they had interpreters. We had a platoon leader who couldn't speak English. And he had an interpreter. So everything was done through an interpreter. But they just didn't believe, you know, that we had possessions that we said we had.
Did you have a car in England?
At that time, no.
So you had to go into a classroom then?
We lived in paper houses of 10 men to a room. In the centre of the camp was a programme. So on Monday morning, we were marched en masse to the programme. We were harangued by the camp commandant in Chinese for yonks and yonks. Then the interpreter would say his bit. And then the camp commandant would go off again, all in Chinese, obviously. Then the interpreter would say his bit, and eventually you would march back again. And one man from the squad had to go to the office, where he was given a list of probably 3 questions on that morning's lecture. And until you had answered those questions to their satisfaction, you couldn't do anything else. So obviously, being what we are, if you didn't understand these questions, you usually have a discussion in the office to find out what they wanted the answer to be. So by the time you got back to your squad, you knew what the answers were to be. And this would go on until they'd ask some question that you couldn't, not couldn't answer, but would answer to their satisfaction. And then things would go a bit haywire for a bit, and people would be dragged up the office and harangued, you'd be harangued, you'd have more lectures, on and on and on, until they simply got the answer they wanted. And it just wasn't worth the effort, really. I mean, you might just well put down the answer they wanted in the first place. But they were extremely subtle in their, what they called a re-education programme. Very, very clever. You started right back in the Industrial Revolution, English history, which you knew about because you learned at school. You knew it's true. And they gradually moved up and up. And they would tell you things that you knew were true because you had learned at school. But gradually they brought their side of it in more and more and more and more, until you didn't know what was true and what wasn't true. In the midst of all this, they would also give you stories of propaganda, one of which was the American German warfare, very, very hot on that, which of course we did not believe one word of. But they started giving us newspapers. We had the Shanghai News, and a magazine, I forgot what that was called, and in there would be photographs of American pilots, sworn statements of German warfare. Then you'd have it on the, in the magazine, you'd see it. They then brought in a tannoy system, and they would broadcast things. And I suppose gradually at the back of the your own mind, you know, you think, well, who is telling the truth? Because you are only ever hearing one side of the story. You never heard the other side. And over a long period of time, you know in your own mind it's not true, but you're always thinking, could it be? You know, is there something at the back of all this? And this is how they worked all the way through. They were very, very subtle with their propaganda. And we used to have, eventually they put electric lights in, and we have to study at night. Half the time we weren't studying, we were playing cards. But at the end of it, I believe I can. I knew three words of Chinese. Things like hot water, air raid. Our platoon leader, who could not speak one word of English when we got there, he could carry on a very reasonable conversation with you in English. He knew which squad you were in, before that, what the age was. He could play bridge, he could play pontoon, chess. Well, we probably ended up learning two words of Chinese. So who was the winner? I don't know.
Did any Westerners come round?
Yes, we had a French communist correspondent. I can't remember his name. Dave came to give us a talk, but I don't think he got very far because we all started singing Rule Britannia and nobody took a blind bit of notice of what he said anyway. But yes, he did. There was that chap. I can't remember the name.
Were any of the POWs won over by the Chinese?
I believe one was, yeah. I think it was a Marine, if I remember right.
Did you know him?
No.
Were you fed and accommodated properly?
We were accommodated to the, I suppose you might almost say the best that North Korea could offer. We were accommodated in wooden huts with paper sliding doors. We were fed weren't fed very well on the march up there because it was all mash and barley. But gradually, as time went by, then we started to get rice on a Sunday. We always had a little side dish of either a vegetable or peanuts or something like that. But you see, that is another funny thing, because when the winter came, the first winter, the Chinese said we should only have two meals because the days were very short. And we said, no, we want more food, not less food, because it's so bitterly cold. So we won that one over. As time went on, the food gradually got better. We had flour to make bread rolls, steamed bread rolls, eventually. And always, always boiled water. And milk. They used to make milk from bean curds. And we used to have to go and fetch this about 4 o'clock in the morning. I suppose it will help keep us going. As I say, it's just a question of, as I say, it was bad at the beginning, and gradually as time went on, the living accommodation got better. Because they gave us timber to build bunks. I think the best improvement we ever had was a decent sit-down toilet instead of squatting on a log. That, I think, boosted a lot of people's morale, you know. We had, about a 10-seater, I think, toilet, which we kept clean, because the Chinese were extremely unhygienic, extremely. They were filthy, in fact. And they used to spit a lot. But we stopped them in the end.
The POW stopped the Chinese?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I don't know. I don't know how it was done, but we just sort of kept on, and we wouldn't do this and we wouldn't do that unless they stopped spitting. They would want us to do something. And we'd say, no, you stop, you know, your filthy habits. Because they would complain about the number of flies, natural thing. And he'd say, well, how can you get rid of the flies when you're spitting all the time? During all this time, we went out to collect wood all through the summer to keep our cook fires going, and our nighttime fires. Every hut had a nighttime fire in it. We shouldn't do, but we used to keep them. They had a fire in it anyway. But every day in the summer, we went out wood collecting. And that really was the best part, if you can have a best part, because you were free. You were sent out into the hills on your own. Although, I mean, the Chinese, hundreds of Chinese guards were surrounding on Shandon Hills to collect wood. But being Chinese, you had to collect a certain amount of wood per day. And if I remember rightly, it was 100 catties. And the quartermaster went with you, and he weighed it. And if it didn't weigh enough, you had add another little bit to it. So you had at least 100 catties. But the weather, you know, well, it was a nice day, and nothing was nicer, really. You were out in the hills on your own. And this wood was, as I say, for cooking our food, and a fire at the end of the hut.
How did your health hold up as a POW?
Me personally, I never had any serious illness at all. Apart from night blindness, I think most of us suffered from, so he was lack of vitamin C, I don't really know. And I got a touch of sunstroke at one period when we'd been working on barges unloading timber. But we were starting to get short of timber around where we were, and they were bringing it in on barges, and I spent a day unloading it. And no part in that, really. I mean, nothing serious at all.
And what about the mental side of it? Did you get depressed or desperate?
I wouldn't say desperate. I mean, you must remember we were very young. Yes, you got depressed at times. But what was a great boost, of course, was if you got a letter from home, because your biggest worry was, did the people at home know you were alive? So once you got a letter from them, that was a great moral booster. But that was a very strange thing, how it came about, because somebody would receive quite a lot of letters and others received none at all. So how they worked it, I've just no idea.
Could you follow how the war was going and the prospects of it ending?